Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the Women in Film Short Film Showcase. I'm happy now to welcome to the program State Senator from Santa Fe, Peter Wirth. He's from District 25. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you. Now, we talk almost every legislative session, I think, and Linda Siegel is here also with the legislative update, but I thought it would be nice to talk to you, who are, you're one of our elected officials on the ground, about what's going on in the Senate, in the Congress of the state of New Mexico right now. One of the things that people are very concerned about, that there's been a lot of publicity about, is the film credit in relation to the entire issue of the budget. What's going on?
Well, it's a good time to visit because we're really at kind of crunch time in the legislative session. 3 weeks to go, and the budget is our number one job, really, during the session, is to come up with a balanced budget. We have a constitutional requirement that we have a balanced budget, a good thing. But, as you might imagine, after all we've been through the last couple of years and these very down times with respect to finances and money in this state, it is going to be tough. And what's happened, the budget at this point is in the state house, and it's held up because of film being a big issue. The Republicans, as a caucus, have decided that they're not going to support any version of the budget that's been worked on during the interim by the Legislative Finance Committee, and then the governor's folks step in and propose their version, and the Republicans made a decision that until this film issue was addressed in the way they wanted it addressed, the way the governor wants it addressed, they basically weren't gonna play ball and come to the table. So as a result, the numbers in the state house now are so close, 36 Democrats, 33 Republicans, and one independent. And what happens when you have groups that just vote together as a block, it becomes much more difficult to come up with those votes. And I think they're working right now to come up with some budget that they can move forward to the Senate, where we will then work on it and see where it comes out. But film is front and center for sure.
So the reality of the film situation is that New Mexico offers benefits for people, both New Mexicans and people from out of state, who want to make films, so that there are financial benefits, credits of various kinds, and so on, that on the one hand cost the state money, on the other hand bring in revenue from all these people being in the state, using the resources and restaurants and film crews and everybody else in New Mexico. Is there disagreement over the facts, over the actual math?
Well, there is some disagreement, and there's been competing results, and I think that's what's been particularly challenging. The current film credit is a 25% credit, and basically what that means is for a dollar in expenses here, the film company gets a 25-cent rebate for money spent. Now, here in Santa Fe, we all see firsthand how important the film industry has been. I can't tell you the number of business owners that have told me, Republicans, Democrats, independents, that but for the film business, they wouldn't have made it through the last 2 years.
What specifically? Like, what's an example of
that? Well, a perfect example is a hotel who sees huge influx when the crews are in town. They have people staying in that hotel, restaurants, landlords that own space. The film industry rents space. And so there's all kinds of different industries that cater to film, and I truly believe here in Santa Fe, probably for every dollar we put in, we get $3 or $4 back. Now, in the rest of the state, kind of in the more rural areas, they don't see as much film, and so there's been a pushback. What the governor's proposed is to reduce the amount of the credit from 25% to 15%. What's really scary about that is that film is so mobile that they're going to go where they can get the best deal. And the worry is that dropping that percentage could mean a very substantial reduction in the whole film industry being here.
Especially, I mean, there are other states that are actually increasing their credit in the same legislative time period.
That's right. I think the state of Utah just increased its credit. And so we've got states that are increasing, states that are decreasing. Michigan is going down. And the difficult piece is quantifying the full extent of that economic benefit. So what happened in the House, a House committee didn't reduce the amount of the credit. What they did, though, is put a cap on it, $45 million. And so there's been a lot of numbers floated around as to where that the proper amount should be, whether a cap is appropriate. Right now, there is no cap.
What do we pay out every year?
Well, it depends. It's varied on different years. I believe that it's gone $70 million. It started out lower. It's kind of ratcheted up. Then it's come back down. And so $45 million would be a significant reduction. There's been a lot of discussion about a $60 million possible cap. Again, those of us in the Senate have not been involved in these negotiations at all.
Yeah.
This is just the House side, and then it's going to come over to the Senate. But I can certainly say that from my perspective, we need to figure out exactly how this industry impacts our state. And Senator Tim Keller, one of my colleagues in the Senate from Albuquerque, passed a bill through the Senate this week that will do that, basically require film companies to do that analysis so that we can really understand what this is and what it means to our state. I just worry that kind of taking the machete approach and just hacking away at it could have really dire consequences, especially as we're just beginning to come out of this economic downfall.
Well, and the question is not only how many dollars are brought in, but then how much revenue of that comes back into the state coffers.
Absolutely. As I said, I think here in Santa Fe, my gut tells me it's $3-4 for every dollar we put in. And so
taxes.
That's right. That comes back. And the interesting piece is that we have about $1.3 billion worth of deductions, exemptions, credits, loopholes in our tax code. And on one hand, I commend the governor for being willing to take a look at the film, because I'm not saying we shouldn't look at it. I personally don't think that's the one you start out with and cut, given where we are, when you've got oil and gas subsidies and all these other different exemptions and loopholes. One that I'm working on, the corporate tax loophole,
right.
Senate Bill 6. And I just think that it's funny, when you're in a downtime like this, in a way it's an opportunity to do some things we could never do otherwise. I have tried this corporate loophole that I've been trying to close each year I've been in the legislature. I kind of feel like Don Quixote here. We're the last Western state with a corporate tax that allows this, and multi-state corporations can create subsidiaries in states where there is no corporate tax and expense profits that otherwise would be taxable here in New Mexico to the state with no tax. It's not fair to our New Mexico businesses that pay this corporate tax, and it just doesn't seem right to me.
So the way it works is if you have a New Mexico company, they pay corporate taxes. If you have an Arizona company that has a big, huge building here and makes a lot of money, they don't pay taxes?
Well, they have a choice. They don't all. What happens for multi-state corporations, they can either file what's called a combined return, which uses a formula. It looks at their payroll, property, and sales and allocates that amongst all the different branches of the corporation wherever they may be located. Or New Mexico, again, still allows what's called a separate return. And so it allows a company to be able to expense profits to a subsidiary that does in a state where there's no corporate tax.
So as an example, do Walmart and Target and so on pay corporate taxes in New Mexico?
Well, again, all these tax, all the information is proprietary, which has been a challenge with film. People say, well, we can't figure out exactly what's happening. It's also proprietary with our C corporations. They're the corporations that pay this tax. But let me say this, we have had specific cases, we can go after these companies on a case-by-case basis. And our tax department has challenged Walmart and won. We also had a big case against Kmart that went up through our Supreme Court, and that also showed that some of this transfer pricing and transfer of assets was happening. So it happens here. The big question is the extent and how much is in the game. Estimates, again, I've carried the bill so long now that we've seen all kinds of estimates. At one point, it was $90 million.
That would be gained if this loophole were closed.
Correct, if this loophole were closed. This year, I think the FIR, the Fiscal Impact Report, says somewhere between $17 and $35 million. It's hard to know until you close the loophole.
Well, that would buy a few teachers' salaries.
It would. And interestingly, Mary Charlotte, it's about the same amount that the governor wants to get by cutting this film credit.
Right.
Why not look at this? And I'm actually, this week, the bill is going to be heard, I think, this Friday for the first time in the Senate Corporations Committee. And I am going to take a little bit of a different approach. We're actually going to lower slightly the corporate tax rates. The top tax rate now on income over $1 million is 7.6%. We're going to lower that down to 7%, and then there's some lower tiers as well that we're going to drop down by that same 0.6%. Thereby, those New Mexico companies that are currently paying this tax, guess what? They get a tax reduction.
But then everybody else has to pay.
That's right. You bring everybody together. It's kind of basic tax policy. How do we broaden the base, get more people paying, and then lower the rates? And in this case, we can broaden the base, lower the rates, and lo and behold, we'll still bring in money for the state. So it's kind of a win-win. And these are the kinds of tax policy discussions that we've never, since I've been in the legislature, we're just getting into the meat of these, which is great. I mean, it's an important thing that needs to happen.
We're talking to State Senator Peter Wirth from Santa Fe District 25. When the legislature started, there was an article on the front page of the New Mexican that compared the oil and gas subsidies to the film subsidies, and the oil and gas subsidies were considerably higher. They were almost twice as much, I think, when you looked at the numbers. And when you think about those industries, they are more mature industries, and they're also not mobile the way film is. You want to film a desert landscape, you can go to Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, or Texas. But if you have a drilling location, you can't just move that somewhere else in the same way. And so it seemed like, well, let them at least come into line with everybody else.
Sure. I truly think this is a perfect example. We need to look at all of these. And I don't think anything should be off the table. We had an interesting debate this week about a tax credit that goes to Southwest Airlines for fuel. They're in a position where the plane could certainly fuel up in Dallas, fly to New Mexico, not fuel here, fly to Arizona, fuel up in Arizona. And so there's a very interesting tax policy. How do you adjust the rate so they're paying something here to encourage them to fuel up here, which results in gross receipts tax? And so it's this, you need to look carefully at each one of these and revisit them. We haven't done that. During my first 4 years in the House, from 2005 to 2008, there was a lot of money in the state, more than the state had ever seen. And we did a couple things together, Democrats, Republicans. We certainly increased spending on teacher salaries, on health care, things that the state really needed. We also, though, together, cut a lot of taxes, and there would be an omnibus bill each year, $100 million in gross receipts taxes, all put together for everything you could ever imagine, and we did it together. So we spent money, we cut taxes. I just think, given where we are now, together, this can't be a partisan issue. We need to look at ways to make government work better, but we also need to look at the revenue side. And I don't think you can look at the government and without, in a situation like this, ensuring that the key priorities, education, healthcare, things that need to be funded, have the resources they need.
I did a calculation right at the beginning of the legislative session that if every working family in New Mexico paid, I think it was between $10 and $20 a month per person, the whole entire budget would be balanced. And when you think about what that means for a family, maybe $20 or $30 a month extra for a family, that money in your pocket does not buy you a first grade teacher or a county health program or whatever.
No, I think that's right. And again, what we did in 2003 was basically take all the progressivity out of our income tax rates. And so the top tax rate is 4.9%. It applies to someone, I think an individual who makes more than $16,000. The same rate's going to apply to someone who makes $16,000 and someone who makes $16 million.
Right.
And so, again, at some point, I hope we can have a rational discussion about tax policy. Certainly all the exemptions, loopholes, but I think also being smart about how we do it. I like to remind my colleagues that Ronald Reagan, in 6 of his 8 years as president, raised taxes.
I know.
And it's amazing how fast we have forgotten that the tax tool is part of what you have to look at when you're in a situation like this.
And the main thing is making it fair. When we look at the national situation, many people are daunted by this whole cutting taxes for the wealthy and then reducing programs for the needy. In New Mexico, you have a bill, Senate Bill 547. Tell us about it. It would require disclosure of expenditures. What's this all about?
Well, this is another big issue that we have, all of us in this country and certainly here in the state of New Mexico, have to deal with following the U.S. Supreme Court's, I think, incredibly misguided decision in Citizens United dealing with corporations and giving them First Amendment rights. And basically what it's meant is that a whole new cottage industry of what are called independent expenditure committees have been developed and have funneled in huge amounts, unlimited amounts of corporate money into the political system. And to be fair, it's not just the corporations, it's also union money that comes in. Senate Bill 547 is something that I've been working on with Common Cause. And it's an attempt to do one of the few things that Citizens United, the decision, allows us to do, which is require disclosure of donors of those independent expenditure committees. And also for other non-political committees, such as nonprofits that are out there educating, which they have every right to do under the First Amendment, it sets some boundaries right before the elections when if they go out and quote-unquote educate about a candidate without specifically advocating or taking a position against a candidate, it requires some disclosure. So again, I think that putting sunshine on those donors, letting us know where this money's coming from, is an important step, because right now without this bill, we're not going to know, and it's going
to... Basically, we're not going to know who's contributing to political campaigns.
Well, not to political campaigns, because if it's a political campaign, they're required to report under our Political Reporting Act. These, though, are what are called independent expenditure committees. They're not affiliated directly with a political campaign.
Okay.
So they can't coordinate with a campaign, but they can sure come in and say, and send in 20 mailers or get on TV... You know, Peter Wirth did X, and they are actively engaged in the political process,
right,
without, amazingly to me, with no limits. I actually carried the bill 2 years ago that finally put campaign limits into New Mexico's system, but that only applies for political committees. These independent expenditure committees, after Citizens United, have again kind of slid out from under our disclosure and our limits law, and this bill is an attempt to kind of do as much as we possibly can do without kind of crossing the First Amendment.
So that's Senate Bill 547, which you are sponsoring. We're talking to State Senator Peter Wirth. Let's talk for a moment about unions. Everybody's got their eye on Wisconsin and that governor's attempt to destroy collective bargaining rights for union members. What are we looking at here? Are there any challenges to unions?
Well, I think there definitely are challenges, and it has to do really with the retirement systems that are in place for our state employees and for our teachers. And again, those pension funds, there are questions about the solvency of those pension funds. And so 2 years ago, we asked our state employees to contribute additional money to their pensions. I think it was 1.5%. There was a sunset on that. I actually did not vote for that bill 2 years ago. I was one of a handful who didn't, because going back to what you said earlier about fairness, it just doesn't seem fair to me that we ask our state employees, our teachers, to be at the table, which they're willing to be at the table, when our multi-state corporations are not there, those highest income earning citizens are not there. I just don't think that's fair. This session, again, we're going to see a whole string of bills to increase contributions to those pensions. That has the effect. It's a pay reduction. Even though the money's going into the solvency of the pension, that's less money that's coming home. That's less money that's going into our Santa Fe economy. And again, I'm not saying that we don't need to be prudent about our pension funds. We do. But I do, again, it just doesn't seem right to me that we don't have all the players around the table. So those bills are going to be coming through as well. We've not seen any attempt to roll back the collective bargaining provisions that exist in state law, similar to what's happened in Wisconsin, which I think would be the straw that would kind of trigger, I would assume, a similar response here. But again, it's this idea that we all together had the benefits of the spending when times were good. Now times are tough, and all of a sudden we've limited those that are going to participate. I just don't think that's right.
Let's talk for a moment about the issue of renewable energy bonds. There's a bill, Senate Bill 266.
Yeah, this is a bill that actually just went through the Senate yesterday, and it is a bill that establishes a process to allocate some federal qualified energy bonds. These were given to all the states in the stimulus bill, and New Mexico has $20.6 million sitting here at the state, and what this bill would do is allocate that money for public or private energy conservation projects. The reason this is important for Santa Fe is that Santa Fe has $1.5 million allocated in these bonds in this bill, and so if we can get this through, that'll be money that the County of Santa Fe wants to use in its renewable energy financing program that they're trying to kick off with respect to commercial properties. This is a bill that I carried, and Representative Egoff had a similar type bill a couple of years ago. It allows counties to create a district, and then folks can borrow money on their property tax assessment. And it's a great idea that's worked in different places across the country. Unfortunately, though, the federal regulators and the mortgage lenders were concerned that these special assessments, because the payback would be on your property tax bill each month, they were concerned about that payback getting a priority over the mortgage. And so these programs are on hold at the residential level, but Senate Bill 647 from 2 years ago that I carried allows a commercial program as well. And the reason this is exciting is that putting this money in, installing new renewable systems, we're talking green jobs, putting people to work, and of course the benefit of saving energy, doing the right thing for our planet, and that whole piece as well.
So it would help, for example, a hotel put solar hot water systems on the roof so that they didn't use gas to heat water anymore.
Absolutely. And what it would do, what's really interesting, you can finance 100% of that cost through the bond, and then you get a 40% tax credit the first year. And so if you think about it, no money out of pocket, you're getting 40% back.
Right.
Talk about, this was one of the stimulus.
That's what you
this
call
is,
stimulus.
This is what you call stimulus.
Okay.
So it's a good one.
That's Senate Bill 266. We've got two more that I want to talk about in the little time we've got left. There's been so much talk about driver's licenses, immigrant driver's licenses, youth provisional driver's licenses. What's going on?
Well, my little venture kind of unexpectedly into this whole debate right on the Senate floor, I had a bill, Senate Bill 9, that involves our youth drivers, and it was a task force to look at permits and provisional licenses. We have a graduated driver's license in New Mexico. It's a terrific program, and the Attorney General had a task force over the last couple of years to look at ways to make it work better. That's what this bill, Senate Bill 9, did. Somewhat perhaps naively, I didn't fully think through that any bill related to driver's licenses necessarily would trigger a big debate with respect to the immigrant driver's license issue.
And so somebody tried to amend it?
Well, they tried to amend it in committee. We were successful in stopping that. And then the bill came to the floor of the Senate. And we had three different attempts to amend out the sections that involve the youth drivers also have provisions with respect to the immigrant driver's license. And there were three attempts by my Republican colleagues to strip that language from the existing statute, even though it had nothing to do with the bill that was before the body. And so we had a very interesting procedural, constitutional. I used some of the rules that we have on our books to argue that those attempted amendments were not germane to this bill.
What was the bill?
The bill was the youth driver's bill, and it was related to youth driving. It had nothing to do with the immigrant driving issue.
But it basically made youth driver's licenses somehow harder to get, or?
No, it ended up, as it went through the committee, it kept the ages where they were, but it addressed violations. For example, if you get a violation, it extended for 30 days the different step-ups. There's a six-month window with a permit,
okay,
and then a year with a provisional. If you get violations, an additional 30 days, just slowing things down. And perhaps most importantly, it's got a provision, no cell phones or texting for our kids.
Yes.
While they're driving. And so that...
Nobody's allowed to use cell phones or text when they're driving.
Well, here in Santa Fe, but remember across...
Oh, this is for the whole state.
Exactly.
Ah, okay.
Exactly. So just, and again, sends an important signal, and eventually the bill passed, I think, with only one vote in opposition, but we had a full-blown four-hour floor debate with all kinds of constitutional challenges and through the chair, and in the end, I think almost all the Democrats voted against placing those amendments onto this particular bill. Now, there are bills that are in the legislature seeking to roll back the immigrant driver license provisions in our statute. So far, the bills in the House have been tabled, left in committee, and I think the bill in the Senate was introduced very late, so I certainly haven't seen it in the Judiciary Committee where I sit yet.
The last one that we've got time to talk about, we've only got a minute or so left, is there is a bill, Senate Bill 11, that would allow doggies on leashes on patios of restaurants such as the Santa Fe Baking Company.
And only if the Santa Fe Baking Company wants to do it.
Yes.
And it's an interesting, the Senator Michael Sanchez, our majority floor leader today, called it the puppy bill. So it's been on the floor of the Senate. We're just waiting to debate it. Lots of my colleagues are looking forward to the debate. We will, I'm sure, have amendments to include lizards and cats and chupacabra. I think we had that discussion. But in all seriousness, it's turned out to be something I didn't fully expect. It's a real, I think my good friend and predecessor Max Call called it an economic development bill. We've got 19 restaurants in Santa Fe that want to do this. The Restaurant Association statewide has testified solidly in support of this bill. Lots of folks travel with their dogs.
Yeah.
Lots of folks, especially in these tough times, like to spend time with their four-legged friends. And again, it's only on outdoor patios. It's not inside the restaurant. It's only for restaurants that want to participate. And so we'll have a debate. It'll be good.
Peter Wirth is state senator from Santa Fe District 25. I want to thank you so much for telling us all about this and being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Janet Davidson. She's co-chair of Women in Film International and filmmakers Debriana Mancini, and joining us by phone, Deborah Haywood. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Hello.
So, Janet, tell us, there is this Friday and Saturday here in Santa Fe, there's a short film showcase coming up, and you're the producer of it.
Yes, actually, that is going to be across the globe. We're in 33 countries and states. This same showcase, and it'll be showing next week. For instance, we're going to Los Angeles on Tuesday, Monday, where it's going to be in Los Angeles. But it's a compilation of our members who have sent in to each one of their chapters two choices that the chapters end up sending to me. And then the choice was narrowed down from there so that we could make this DVD, which really highlights this tremendous talent and unsung talent that's out there with women filmmakers.
And so it's quite a competitive process.
It can be. I know Montreal snuck in four. They were only supposed to do two, but they snuck in four. And I said, oh, darn ya.
And so also it's an opportunity which people don't usually have except during film festivals to see short films, which are often the place where new filmmakers debut their work because, of course, they haven't been able to get funded to make a 90-minute or more film. But you can make a 5-minute film or a 20-minute film with minimal expense and get it out there.
Some of these are quite expensive, and I must say that I did a survey on where they all got their money from, and quite a few of them have been helped by their governments, even Minnesota. I think even more than that, it's a place where you can really explore subjects that the regular media is maybe a little too frightened to take on. You can really, believe it or not, in 15 minutes tell a story from beginning to end that can be quite startling and earth-changing for people.
And speaking of which, let's talk about Deborah Haywood's film for a moment. Deborah, your short film is called Sis, and it's about... I mean, it's very affecting. I mean, it's about a little girl who is asking her older sister what the word pedo means, as somebody has scrawled that graffiti on a man's door in the neighborhood. And the older sister, not thinking, says, oh, it's a man who likes children. And it goes on from there. How did you conceive of this film?
I'm not really sure. It's one of those occasions that really rarely happens. But I was in the cinema and I was watching an unrelated film. And suddenly this image popped into my head of this little girl with, you know, a balloon up her top and fake boobs kind of thing. And then the whole short just spouted out. And I was just, like, scrambling around looking for paper and tried to write it down. But, I mean, really, I think it comes from a lot of places. I think as a child, I was obsessed with... you know, being pregnant and having boobs and just like women's bodies and breastfeeding. And I think that we all are. I mean, I know my daughter was regularly giving birth to cushions when she was little. And so I think I must have thought, oh, you know, what is the worst thing that can happen to this little girl who's going around dressed as an adult? And I suppose it's, you know, to track down an unsuitable man.
And it definitely, I mean, it's done in such a short time, and it's so compactly done, the way it kind of plays into that whole thing that, as you say, all little girls do, which is dress up as adults, but also the way they very innocently sexualize themselves and have no idea what they're doing in the process.
Yes, I mean, I did want it to be all about innocence, you know, like doing handstands and showing the knickers and, you know, taking everything at face value because, you know, children are innocent. And so that's something that I wanted to explore, how that innocence can be used to tell a really serious story, but also hopefully in a humorous way as well, because I think there's a lot of humor between those gaps of... you know, what you're saying and what you're meaning sort of thing.
And it also, I mean, without giving away too much of the film, it raises questions about the innocence or guilt of people who did something once in the past and to what extent they should or shouldn't be stigmatized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hope that it's ambiguous whether this man is a paedophile or he isn't, because I think when you're a children, especially, if there's somebody a bit odd in the neighbourhood, he automatically gets branded as, you know, a weirdo or a paedophile or something, when really maybe he's just a bit strange. And but also on the estate where we shot, I didn't realise at the time, but some children were telling me that actually there is a man who lived on that estate that people say he is a paedophile. And, you know, they all go and throw eggs at his window and terrorise him. But I've no idea if he's on the sex offenders list or not. You know, there's been a lot of controversy in England over the last few years because paedophiles and sex offenders, you know, there's been public lists made. So, you know, you can find out if your neighbour's a paedophile or not, sort of thing.
So this film is screening in Santa Fe and indeed all over the world this Friday and Saturday night. Deborah, do you have any new projects in the works?
I've just finished a new one called Biatch, which is about a girl who gets off with her best mate's boyfriend. So I'm a bit nervous about how that's going to be received because this has done so well and now I feel this pressure to be, you know, deliver something that people like, but I've got no idea if they're going to like it or not. But, I mean, that's all we can do is just keep chipping away and, you know, make something for ourselves and then hope that other people like it as well.
Debriana Mancini of KSFR fame and a person very active around town in theater and film. You've made an animation.
I did.
That's so cute.
Thank you.
It's about a kitty.
Yeah, it is about a kitty. I co-wrote it with a friend of mine in L.A. when I was living there. We used to go on walks and talk about our pets and our families and things like that. And one day we were talking about our cats and we started exchanging stories. And when I got home, I called her back and I said, "Hey, Anne, I think we can write a children's book about this. Do you want to do it with me?" And she said, "Okay." So we started writing the story. And as I had never any intention of illustrating it whatsoever. And but I wanted to be able to tell the illustrator what I wanted because I had really specific images in my mind. So I would storyboard it along. And one day Anne said to me, "You know, I like your images. They fit our story. Why don't you do it?" So I did. And I kept it for a long time. And then my husband pulled it out one day and said, "I think I can animate this for you. Why don't I try doing that? And we'll see what happens." So we did. And that's how we came up with Picking Up Feats.
Picking Up Feats. Feats, of course, is the name of the little kitty.
Yeah.
And this is an example of how, with minimal resources, mm-hmm. you can make a short film.
Yes, we did.
Magic markers.
Yeah, magic markers. I had I knew what I wanted. You know, I could see the images in my mind. So she would have gotten me anything I wanted to produce the image. So I just said I want those watercolor markers because I wanted the colors to be strong and bold and primary, and because that's the story. I mean, it's a pretty clear story, and it was the only male in the story is the cat.
And it's a breath of fresh air in a sometimes very serious group. There's a couple of breath of fresh airs in this, though, but it really comes at a nice place, and it's the only animation, and I might say that the only other time New Mexico was represented in the International Showcase was also an animated spot that ended up on there. And it was Kate Wolf's. Yes, I think that's it. And it was just magnificent and very interesting that we're twice in animation here.
Is that the same Kate Wolf who has a film in this one?
No. Mm-mm. Kate Wolf is a New Zealand gal in this one. Yeah. Each chapter ultimately was only allowed one per chapter to go up there. And there was one chapter that, quite frankly, they were all so bad that I talked to the president of that chapter and I said, "You know, next year."
right.
Believe me, I'm beyond thrilled to be in this group of very, very talented people.
So we're talking about Women in Film, Women in Film New Mexico, Women in Film International, the short film showcase that is coming up on Friday and Saturday night here in Santa Fe. So, I mean, you can't obviously tell us all the plots, but give us a rundown of some of the variety, Janet Davidson, of other short films that are going to be in this showcase.
Oh, my. Well, it's very interesting because it starts out with a film, What Kind of Planet Are We On? And it's a very interesting little film and ultimately is very timely because it is about same-sex social security. And the ability to collect death benefits when you've been married for many, many years to a same-sex partner. And it was very interesting also because Nigeria, for the first time, has joined in. There is a Nigerian chapter, actually. And Nigeria, she wrote me after she got the DVD that I sent her, and she was really upset because she said, we can't show this here. My sentiments may be with you, but we cannot do anything about same-sex. And then about the pedo, as she called it, she said, yes, we have pedos, but we can't show that here. And the New Zealand film, This Is Her, has briefly simulated sex. I mean, but it's not in a very comic, very, very good taste, and they're not naked. But she said they couldn't show that either.
Wow.
And so I had never...
Meaning there's rules or there's just social customs?
Social customs that they... And we I haven't heard from India because we have a new chapter for me in India and Abu Dhabi now. And I'm quite sure they might be having the same problem. The Indian chapter called us with some amazing problems they were having on the sets, which sounded like us 30 years ago, where they had, for instance, she said not one woman is allowed to do hair or makeup in India.
Oh, my gosh.
On the set. And I looked, and I said to her, I said, well, you know, when I started years ago, there were no women doing hair and makeup on the sets, just as there were no women directors or ADs in those days. They were all done by men, and it was a powerful position because Bud Westmore and Max Factor, they all started there. So they're about 30 years behind us, and I guess Nigeria is easily that too. And so you forget that other countries can't show what we can show, and I hope this country remains a country that we're free to show these wonderful, wonderful cutting pieces of life.
So how are women doing, Janet, as directors, as filmmakers, and so on? I mean, we've always been actors of female parts, but other than that, behind the scenes and in high positions?
Well, it seemed like it was getting better, and it was getting better. There was no two ways about it. I know people know this story, and they never want to hear it again, but when I joined the Directors Guild in Los Angeles sued all the producers on behalf of minorities and women so we could work. And from that lawsuit, which was denied because the Directors Guild was equally guilty of it, we were forced to sit with the producers every so many weeks and hash out our problems. And because of that, I actually started working. And then it was my business, and I was determined to only hire women and minorities behind me so that we could get a good workforce trained and out there. And it really seemed like it was done. I mean, last year, Catherine Bigelow got the Oscar. It seemed like finally we were breaking the ceiling. Well, the new figures came out, and now 7% of feature films are directed by women.
7%?
7%. That's last year's total.
Wow.
It seems like it's better, but if you pick up the Directors Guild magazine for each month and see the screening, you may see one woman in 20.
And, you know, there are people who say, when you say, wow, I hired only women and minorities, people might say, wow, you're not even hiring on the basis of merit, you're hiring on the basis of that prejudice. But as you say, it is only when you have a workforce of people that then they start mentoring other people, and then you have even the chance of equality.
Oh, believe me, I fired many a woman who didn't match up. You know, I had no problem turning around and saying, you're out of here. No, I would say it nicely. I would say, perhaps you would like a different career than this. You know, and many of them did, and many of them were much better at what they then chose to do. It's being in the film industry is not for everybody. It's a tough, tough job, and you got to have the chops to do it.
I have to say, Mary Charlotte, it's interesting that we're talking about this because I have a friend on Facebook that I don't know him, but he's in, you know, other than just on Facebook, he's in Finland. And when I announced that my film had been selected for this program, he Facebooked me back and he said, why is there a women in film? Why do women need special help? You know, I'm trying to get my film out there and I don't have any special help. And I said to him, you know, it's not special help. Do you realize how underrepresented we are as a group? Of course we have to come together and support each other. That's what this is about. And he was having none of it. And so it's interesting how people still, I don't know, they don't see how underrepresented we are in this industry.
Deborah Haywood, what does this look like from your point of view in the UK?
Well, I think the figures are about the same in the UK. What I have noticed is that there are a lot of women making short films, but they don't seem to make that transition to make feature films. And I'm not sure why that is. I don't know whether it's to do with confidence or you get bullied or squeezed out on your way up. I'm not really sure what it is, but, you know, it's definitely a battle. And I think also when you do make a film, like often the programmers are men, so I think naturally we gravitate towards, you know, seeing ourselves on the screen. You know, and probably if I was a female programmer, I'd want to pick stories about women. And so, you know, it's all the way down the food chain from production and from development, and, you know, it's all the way. You know, it is male dominated, and it is quite scary, actually. At the same time, I know we have to toughen up, but I don't want to act like a man to get a film made. I want to, you know, tell women's stories and in a female way. So.
Yeah, Catherine Hargrove, who did the first Twilight, which I think grossed $400 billion, couldn't even get an interview for any kind of for the new Batman or one of the new super flick shows, the tentpole shows. She couldn't even get an interview. And when I started directing in television, it was very clear that they had a number system. You could have maybe two women per 22. Or maybe if you were an extremely enlightened show, like my first directing assignment was on Cagney and Lacey. So if you were a somewhat enlightened show, you may be able to have four. But really there was, and it seemed to be not the showrunners that were doing that as much as the network. And I must say I've seen some stars who did not want women directing them either, which I always found that very interesting, yes.
Wow.
Because
they
kind of gravitate towards thinking daddy is right and daddy can tell them the right thing to do.
Were there mommy issues?
There may be. I don't know. Or competition or whatever. You know, it's so complicated. When I first started, I remember other women turning and saying, well, you're good looking, so you'll move ahead. And that, whether or not that was true, the reality was a lot of men didn't want to take women on location because then their wives would go crazy. It got so crazy complicated. I have one director when I was an assistant director, and I hired a fantastic second AD, and he started screaming at me that he already had one woman on the set. Why did he need another one?
Oh, my goodness. So we are not out of the Stone Age yet, ladies and gentlemen. Janet Davidson is co-chair of Women in Film International. She's producer of the short film showcase that's showing in Santa Fe and all over the world this Friday and Saturday at the CCA in Santa Fe. You can get more information at New Mexico Women in Film, which is nmwif.com.
Friday, it will start at 7. Saturday, our SAGE Award event, which this year is Barbara Martinez-Chetner, who is coming in from Mexico, I think she's coming in. She's doing another amazing film and another project for HBO. Her career has been nothing but supporting women and shining light on terrible atrocities across the globe, and especially in Mexico. So that will happen at 6, then we'll show the film at 7, and then you're all invited down at 8:30 for a reception down in their wonderful new gallery, or the gallery that's done for the 18 Days Women in the Arts event.
Yes, 18 days, that's right. Debriana Mancini has a film in the showcase, and Deborah Haywood also. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
And I just forgot to say about the teen event.
Oh, right.
That happens at 3 o'clock at the CCA on Saturday. Every young lady, under 25, teen, that wants to know anything about the film
industry.
Under
25 is teen?
Well, a teen and under 25 will take. Yeah, you know, ask Charlie Sheen.
All right, whatever.
In any case, we will be visiting with them, and they can come right up to Debriana, right up to me, and say, how did you do it, and what did you do, and all of that in a very comfortable setting. It's just us in a wonderful, comfortable setting for them. So bring your kids.
Excellent. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.